Good morning. Be seated, please. First case on our calendar is 98-921, State of Ohio versus Sean Carter. Mr. Newhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, Chief Justice of the Police Court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. September of 1997, Sean Carter, 18 years old at the time, had just been released from the Geauga County Jail where he served a sentence on death charge. Mr. Carter, the appellant here, had already been told by his adoptive mother, Evelyn Carter, that he was no longer welcome in her home because of his psychological problems and the inability of the Carter family to deal with Sean's problems. So Sean had on occasion stayed with, in essence, his adoptive grandmother, Evelyn Carter's mother, Vader Prince, the victim in this case. However, Mrs. Prince herself and Sean appeared there looking for a place to stay after getting out of jail. They decided that she too had had enough of Sean's psychological problems and misbehavior, and she told Sean that he was not welcome, so he left her residence. But he was unable to find a place to stay, and so in the middle of the night, around 3 o'clock in the morning, he came back to the place, came in through an open window, and called out to her to let her know that he was back there, begged her for a place to stay for just a week until he could find some place. But Mrs. Prince would have none of that. She had had enough of Sean. She decided that he must leave, and he must leave immediately. An argument developed between Mrs. Prince and Sean, and according to the really the only eyewitness evidence there is in this case are the two confessions of Sean himself. And according to his confessions, when the argument turned to the point where Mrs. Prince began to shove Sean, he seemed to almost blank out. The next thing you know, he has grabbed a knife. Mrs. Prince is found in the basement of the home with 18 stab wounds, the fatal wound being the wound that nicked the aorta. Sean, I think it's clear from the record, is the type of a person with psychological problems and some limited mental abilities, and candidly, the type of person who doesn't think past the end of his nose. So now he is in the basement and sees Mrs. Prince there. He panics, attempts to cover her body with some clothing, goes upstairs, puts a pot of chicken, turns it on low, turns the water on in the bathroom and closes the door, and leaves a note on the table suggesting that whoever might find it that perhaps Mrs. Prince had taken Sean to the hospital. He then, again, thinking past the end of his nose, decides, I've got to leave. He takes the Chevette, and he takes some money from Mrs. Prince's purse. He drives around sort of aimlessly, and a day or so later is found sleeping in Beaver County at a place called Morgan's Hill. He's brought back to Ohio after waiving extradition, and the Trumbull County Grand Jury charged him with aggravated murder, with rape, with aggravated burglary for going into Mrs. Prince's home, and for aggravated robbery for taking the money. There were, of course, the three A7 specifications for those three felony offenses attached to the indictment. The case went to a jury trial. At the conclusion of the evidence, the defense asked for instructions on lesser included offenses. One of those instructions was permitted, the other were refused by the trial judge. The lesser included, which was permitted, one which was not objected to by the state, was the lesser included offense of criminal trespass as to the aggravated burglary, the argument, of course, being that he came in through the window and, as it's yelled out to her.
Given the evidence, is there any question in your mind about the rape?
Yes, there is, Your Honor.
Because that would sort of dissuade me, I think, from your point of view that he suddenly went blank, because that was an affirmative act. If he's the party, the rape was an affirmative act.
Well, with all due respect, Justice Douglas, I'm not sure that I agree with that, because I think that if you go into a rage, I think that you can do other things besides
kill someone. We can follow up on that. Not only the rape was an affirmative act, but putting the heavy foresight to put the chicken in the pot and leave the nose and all of that, how could a person who was in a blank state think of all these things? These were calculating deeds on his part to mislead anyone who came into the house.
That may be true, Justice Resnick, but I think those are things that happen afterwards, because if you look at the transcripts and if you look at the videotape and listen to the audio tape, there's sort of this period where when she pushes him, that's kind of it for him for a while. He remembers grabbing a knife. He doesn't remember much about the beating, although there's evidence that she's beaten about the face. And the next thing you know, that he seems to remember as he picks up the story, is there she is in the basement, bloody. And that's sort of the point of what I was saying before. He doesn't think past the end of his nose. Now, there she is, and now he has to think, what the heck do I do? So I guess that I would respectfully disagree with any characterization that he had planned the whole thing out in advance. But to get back to your question, Justice Douglas, if I may, concerning the rape, I do think that there's conflicting evidence, and we think that's one of the reasons why the trial judge was wrong in not giving a lesser included instruction on the rape, because Dr. German, as you'll recall, testifies. Dr. Cox had the theory that although he found no signs of physical trauma to the rectum, and there was the evidence of sperm inside the rectum, his theory seemed to be that because she was 68 years old, there could be a loosening of the anal ring or the anal cavity, and somehow therefore she could be raped without there being any signs of physical trauma. Dr. German disagreed with that and basically submitted to the jury that after she had died, when there would be the involvement of the relaxing of those muscles as a result of the cessation of life, that sperm which may have been deposited outside of the rectum may have seeped into the rectum.
That was the issue I was getting to, and isn't that an issue of fact?
It is an issue of fact.
And it was given to the jury, and the jury concluded rape.
But the jury, in our argument that we bring in later about Beck against Alabama, our argument is that, yes, the jury did conclude that, but they were only given two options. They were only given the option of either rape or not guilty on rape. What we're suggesting is that there should have been the third alternative. And I think the case law is fairly clear that whether the trial judge thinks that's what happened is not material. It's simply a question of, could a jury reasonably conclude from the evidence that they heard that something other than rape occurred? And if so, then an instruction on a lesser included offense is proper.
Okay, for purposes of argument, let's eliminate the rape. You still have the robbery and the burglary, do you not?
Well, no,
as specifications?
No, sir. We do not have the burglary because...
Well, robbery.
They found guilty of a lesser
yes.
criminal trespass.
Mm-hmm.
We do still have the robbery, and of course, the lawyers asked for an instruction on theft, and we think that they should have given that instruction on theft. The prosecutor in the case argued this court's decision in the Andre Williams case, and basically suggesting, as I read the opinion, that a robbery, the victim of a robbery is still a victim of a robbery, even if the person takes the things after death. What I'm saying here, though, is that the jury should have been given that option. I am not necessarily saying that a jury, given all the proper options, might not still have said, after hearing arguments from the state, where the state, in essence, would have argued the Williams case, saying, look, you can still be a victim of a robbery even if you're dead and the money's taken afterwards. But they also should have heard the defense argument, which is, look, this is a theft. And they could argue to the jury, this kid doesn't see past the end of his nose. This is a kid who made a decision after Mrs. Prince was dead, after he had covered up the body, to say, geez, now what do I do? I've got to take a car. I'm going to need some money. And then he reaches into grandma's purse to take the money and takes the money.
With all due respect, I don't see your distinction between the theft and the robbery at this point. He took the money out of her purse and took the car subsequent to the killing.
Yes, sir.
How is that not robbery,
well,
given the Williamson case?
As I read the Williams case, you say, well, and it's in a continuous course of events.
Uh-huh.
But with due respect to the court, and I candidly don't necessarily agree 100% with the Williams case, but taking it for what it is...
Doesn't surprise me.
But taking it for what it is, I still think that this court, when it decided the Williams case, had before it a set of facts that had already been decided. What we are saying is that the jury should have been given that opportunity. Had they been given that opportunity, and that's what I think the Beck versus Alabama proposition stands for, give the jury the options. If after a full argument by the prosecution, a full argument by the defense about whether it's a robbery or whether it's a theft, and proper instructions from the trial court, if the jury had found him guilty of that robbery specification, perhaps we wouldn't be here to argue that issue. But what I'm saying is, this is a jury that certainly demonstrated the ability to distinguish, as evidenced by the fact that when they were handed the opportunity to decide the lesser included defense on the criminal trespass versus the aggravated robbery, they did so.
What element of robbery is missing to make it a theft?
I'm sorry?
What element of robbery is missing to make it a theft?
Well, I think that it could be argued that the force element is gone. If you say, if you use force to obtain the property of another...
She's dead.
Sure she's dead. But an afterthought, to take money, doesn't necessarily mean that it's a robbery. If you use force on someone as a result of that force, you obtain the property, that's a robbery. If you kill someone and then at some point later on decide to take their money, I think at least arguably that's a theft. And I think when I say arguably, that's something that the jury should have decided. Maybe they would have gone against Mr. Carter on that issue and then I would not be standing here. Mm-hmm. But my point is that they were not given that opportunity.
And when given the opportunity between the burglary and trespass, they chose the latter.
Yes, sir. They chose the trespass. And I think that indicates certainly that they were a discriminating jury who wasn't just taking what was necessarily fed to them carte blanche.
A discerning jury, not discriminating.
Well,
right?
Discriminating in the sense that
A discerning jury.
Discerning jury, thank you. The government has cited in response to our arguments this court's decisions in Byros and Joseph, and of course, Byros, in essence, relies upon Joseph. We think that there are a couple of problems with that, with all due respect. One is that the Joseph case, as I read, first of all, deals with specification and does not deal with an essential element of the offense, which is exactly what we have here. Missing in the indictment, in the rape count, is any allegation of sexual conduct whatsoever. We think that's a completely different story from what happened in the Joseph case, where there was a specification, which I recall was an A7 specification, and the court said, in essence, well, the defendant was on notice. Here we don't think the defendant was on notice. I would also point out there's a concurrence in part, a dissent in part, which points out one of the concerns we have, which is that recognizing that the statutes in Criminal Rule 7 allow amendments to indictments, there comes a point in time when those amendments begin to intrude upon the function of the grand jury. An indictment in a capital case must be returned by a grand jury. The grand jury has to find all of those elements.
He wasn't on notice of what?
Well, we say he's not on notice of the charge of rape, and because the specification makes no separate allegations about the conduct, but only refers to the rape, that, in fact, he's not on notice as to the capital specification either, because there's no separate allegation in the A7 specification of rape about sexual conduct. It simply says while committing a rape. And of course, the rape count itself has no mention whatsoever of what's obviously an essential element of sexual conduct. We think, frankly, that this court's decision in Semperis back to 1953 governs this. All crimes are statutory. There are later opinions of this court saying, citing the jurisdiction provisions of Ohio Revised Code, which give jurisdiction to the common police courts, and basically say that common police courts have jurisdiction over crimes. If no crime's alleged, then therefore the common police court has no jurisdiction. The government has cited...
When you say no crime's alleged, it did say rape.
in terms of setting forth the allegation of rape, the word rape or statute? Yes, sir.
Okay, that would be a crime.
Well, rape is a crime, yes.
Yes. So what you're saying it didn't say is to wit he did on such and such a day engage in sexual conduct.
Yes. And the missing words are engaged in sexual conduct. That's right.
So it's not enough to just set forth the primary rate, but you have to set forth all of the operative underlying elements.
You have to set forth all of the essential elements. I don't think it has to be a bill of particulars, but I think you do have to set forth the essential elements, and I think that's what Zimmer says. The government indicated that it was going in oral argument to talk about the O'Brien case. We think O'Brien is distinguishable. O'Brien was a case where the defendant was charged with child endangering, and the indictment failed to allege references, but of course the statute in effect at the time did not have a culpable mens rea state, and was silent. And so basically in this court, the state asked the court to do two things, which was to find child endangering to be strict liability offense, which this court refused to do, and to allow the amendment of the indictment. We think the case is distinguishable for this reason. The child endangering statute has no culpable mental state set forth in it. So there can't be a complaint, I don't think, that there's missing from the indictment and essential elements necessary to state an offense. If the child endangering statute has been found to be constitutional as stating an offense, the fact that the culpable mental state is not there, I don't think, is defective. In addition, there is, of course, another statute in the code that says that if there's no culpable mental state alleged, then either it's strict liability, if it's clear from the statute that it's strict liability, or if not, it's recklessness. Here, however, we have a completely different story because we have a rape count where there's just simply no mention of sexual conduct, which, of course, is the absolute essence of
What should we do about the absence of an objection to that defect?
It's troubling, of course, but I think that the failure to object, nevertheless, I don't see how there can be a waiver when we're talking about subject matter jurisdiction. As I read the decisions of this court, that's in essence what it says. If there's no statutory crime stated, then the court has no jurisdiction, no subject matter jurisdiction, and I don't think subject matter jurisdiction is ever waived. Would it have been more convenient for someone to object? And I think the remedy would have been to have to go back and obtain a superseding indictment. Rather than the court to allow an amendment. But I don't think that waiver is necessarily dispositive of the issue.
And you don't think it made any difference with the fact that you put on a defense concerning the rape because of the fact that jurisdiction is not waived?
No, I can't say a case off the top of my head, but I know that I've read cases that say even if people waive and agree to have a matter presented to the court, they cannot, by their waiver and stipulation, confer subject matter jurisdiction on the court. So
how is it subject matter jurisdiction? The absence of a line in the indictment that sets forth an additional element deprives the court of jurisdiction over the case? Over the case? No. Over that particular crime? I mean, that's fact? I mean, what subject matter is the court deprived of by that?
Well, I'm actually going by this court's opinion in the Semperis case, where they said that conviction based on an indictment which does not charge an offense is void for lack of jurisdiction of the subject matter in the attack. So, I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah,
this court has said that it's subject matter
jurisdiction. Yeah, and that, I don't know that whether that case was a multi-count indictment, was it, as in the death penalty?
It was not,
my
recollection.
It probably was a single crime.
That's my recollection. I think it was some burglary or offense or something
right.
like that.
So then, in that case, of course, it was, if the court didn't have, and our court found, the court didn't have subject matter jurisdiction over that crime. Now, the subject matter because that included the whole case. It's odd to say that here, isn't it?
If I understand what you're asking, maybe you're asking, are these severable matters in essence?
And oddly enough, we don't usually think of subject matter as per element, per crime. We think of it's subject matter jurisdiction for the court. Are you in the right court on the right day? You're not in divorce court for capital crime.
Well, I think it's subject matter jurisdiction, at least as I read the opinions, because you only have jurisdiction over a person where the grand jury has alleged that they've committed a crime. And since Sempras says that all crimes are statutory, if you haven't alleged a statutory crime, then really the only thing for the trial court to do is to rule on the matter of jurisdiction and say, I have no jurisdiction.
But that would only apply to the rape charge.
Yes, and I think I understand what you're saying, what Justice Cook is saying. The difficulty is, I believe, that this, of course, is a death penalty case. And if you look at the record as a whole, if you look at the final arguments, if you look at what the evidence was in the case, I just think it is impossible to say that this is something that we can't sever and set aside and say, well, you know, maybe you're right, Sean Carter. The trial court didn't have jurisdiction over the rape, so we're going to let that go. But candidly, the evidence and the emotional impact, and that goes to the prosecutorial misconduct allegation that we've made, is when you have a situation where a young boy stabs his grandmother and there's suggestion, if not evidence, of penal rape, that's the kind of thing that gets a jury fired up and makes them want to give the death penalty, quite frankly. So I think to pass it off and to say that it's harmless error poses two problems. One is that the Eighth Amendment, of course, requires reliability in the determination of the process of imposing death. And if you simply try to sever that, set it aside, and say, well, we'll set that specification and that conviction aside, I think you have a real problem in terms of the reliability required by the Eighth Amendment. The other difficulty is, frankly, a due process problem in terms of fairness. I want to, if I may, in just a couple of minutes remaining, address a couple of the other propositions there, propositions of law, excuse me. Proposition of law number 3, of course, talks about the prosecutorial misconduct. And I realize what the court has said before concerning prosecutorial misconduct, but there are basically two things that I would like to say about that. One is that this particular prosecutor has been admonished by this court before about misconduct and overtrying the death penalty case. The second is that, as I just suggested in response to Justice Resnick's question about the highly emotionally charged nature of the evidence in this case, when on top of all that type of evidence, you have the prosecutor standing up and saying, I just don't think it's anything other than a clear blanket violation of the obligation not to express a personal opinion. When he says, I believe in my side, I believe the evidence that we have that this defendant is guilty of all the charges, or I wouldn't be here. That runs against all of the opinions suggesting that the attorney for the sovereign should not do that, because although jurors are told that both sides have an equal stance in the case, all of the appellate opinions, both federal and state, recognize that the lawyer for the sovereign holds a special place, and when he steps beyond that bound and expresses his personal opinion, there's a denial of a fair trial, which we think was particularly exacerbated in this case because of the highly charged emotional nature of the evidence. I'd also, in the minute or so remaining, like to say a word or two about Mr. Carter's confidence to stand trial. We, in essence, are complaining, first of all, that he, if not incompetent, that certainly the trial judge ignored his constitutional obligation to look into it further, particularly when Dr. King testified after the NGRI evaluation. And we also have difficulty with Mr. Carter's trial lawyers, because we think there's a due process obligation on their part to bring that evidence to the trial court. In particular, we have a young man who does not like his lawyers, and that in itself isn't anything that suggests incompetence or establishes incompetence. But I think we have to remember that not only does he have to understand the nature of the charges, but he has to be able to work cooperatively with his counsel. And if there's the distinction I would draw is this. If he doesn't work cooperatively with his counsel just because he's a mean kid and doesn't like them, then he's not incompetent. But if he cannot or will not work cooperatively with his counsel because of paranoia as a result of a mental disease or defect, then I submit that he is incompetent. I think that's something that...
Where do we draw the line on that, though? We've seen successive cases where the defendant has said successively, I don't like this set of attorneys, get me new, and the trial court does. And then you get two more, and then two more. Where do we draw the line?
Well,
as to being incompetent as opposed to being obstreperous?
I think that you have to listen to the expert psychological evidence in the case and find out if, as I said, he's just a mean, obstreperous guy who doesn't want to get along with any lawyer because he doesn't like lawyers, because he's mad at the situation he's in or whatever, versus a guy who has, or usually I think what you see in these types of situations is a paranoid feature to his personality, where he's incapable of trusting his lawyers. The obstreperous guy doesn't want to trust his lawyers because that's just the type of person that he is. The paranoid person can't trust his lawyers because of the mental disease.
Can we return just for a moment to Proposition Law Number 3, please, with regard to prosecutorial misconduct? We see in almost every one of these cases the same issue you present. The prosecutors say something like this prosecutor did when he said he believed in his side of the case. He said more than what you've said. He said, I believe in my side. I believe the evidence that we have that this defendant is guilty of all the charges. I wouldn't be here. You say that that's improper. Is it improper for defense counsel to say, this isn't as bad a person as he's been made to sound?
I think there is a distinction there. If the defense counsel is certain to make sure that he's not saying, listen, I know this kid, he's not as bad as you might think, because he steps over the line,
okay,
expressing a personal opinion.
Now what happens when, let's take your example, when defense counsel says that, I know this kid and he's not that bad?
Well, I think the trial judge needs to take some corrective action immediately. He needs to admonish the lawyer outside the presence of the jury, and I think he needs to tell the jury, listen, you have to listen to arguments based upon what the lawyer says the evidence shows. It's improper for him to argue.
See, our problem, counselor, is in all these cases, these are such terrible facts and highly, as you say, highly emotional and charged. The courtroom is, you can cut the tension with a knife. I remember those kind of days. Don't we have to leave some leeway for prosecutors, especially to counter some of the things we see from defense counsel, to say, you know, I believe in my case? How is that error? Shouldn't be there if he doesn't believe in his case, should he?
Shouldn't. Well, no, I don't necessarily agree with that, because we all take an oath to represent. When I stand up and represent a death penalty client, whether in this court or in trial, it doesn't mean that I'm embracing him,
of course not. I understand.
Done. It simply means that I'm arguing that this is what the evidence and the law means in this case. With all due respect, I think what the court needs to do is, and if you believe it needs to be to both sides, that's fine.
That's what I'm asking.
Well, I think a message needs to be sent that we're not going to tolerate this, because candidly, I've tried a number of these death penalty cases, and I do mean this with all due respect, but I have seen trial judges say, when they're considering a proposition, they're going, is it reversible error? In other words, they're not even thinking anymore about is this right or wrong. They're thinking about, can I get away with letting somebody do this without the Supreme Court slapping me down? And I think until this court begins to tell judges and lawyers, no, you cannot do these things. You know, if somebody makes us play within the rules, we're going to play within the rules.
Thank you.
Thank you. If you have Ms. Ennis.
Good
You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to take this opportunity to introduce Attorney Charles Morrow, who's joining me at the council table this morning. Mr. Watkins could join us, but Mr. Morrow's going to come in today. If I could, I'll pick up where we left off with respect to the remarks made by the prosecutor. In this entire trial, which spanned approximately a month by the time to figure in the jury selection, the appellant could come up with exactly four comments by the prosecutor that he viewed as prosecutorial misconduct. I think that, first of all, he's very minimal. Second of all, I would certainly point out to the court that there were never any objection to raise any of these remarks when they were said, and to suggest for one moment that these would rise to the level of plain error is simply not supported by the record given the overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt. So, this court has been very clear in the past that both sides are given wide latitude as far as what they might or might not say in closing arguments. And certainly, the Watson case by this court has also said the prosecutor can give an opinion if that opinion is supported by the evidence. And I think that is also true in this case. So, with that in mind, I simply don't think there's merit to that particular argument. With respect to the argument on the lesser included offenses, particularly the theft count, I do not for one moment believe that the trial court was in error in suggesting or in denying the request for the theft instruction, because this wasn't a theft, it was clearly a robbery, as plenty of cases from this very court would indicate. Mr. Newhaus mentioned very briefly the Byros case, where he had an incident where a young woman had been killed, and the defendant was literally dragging her out of the wooded area and removed a ring from her finger. She was clearly dead. There was no question about that. This court basically said, just because this robbery, because the removing of the property was perhaps an afterthought, that does not mean that you are not guilty of aggravated robbery. This court in the Smith case clearly said the victim need not be alive at the time that the property is removed. In
your argument is that Hugh has seemed to argue that if the defendant here made his decision to rob his grandmother, he went in and killed her with no intention to rob her, and then after he robbed her, he realizes that there's some money, and so he forms a decision to take the money at that point. That could be, the jury could find that was a theft offense. Your argument is that our cases don't say that. Our cases say that even if the decision to rob, move the ring, or here to take the money is made after, even if the jury were to decide that the decision to rob his grandmother was made after he killed her, that would still be aggravated robbery.
Correct. That's simply the case that this very court stands down time and time again, that this argument where, okay, the victim is dead, so how can you possibly have the force element? That argument has not flown with this court for a number of years, and I certainly don't think it should apply in this particular case, because it is so similar to the Byron's case, Williams' case, Rohan, Smith, and a number of them that I cite for you in my brief, that a dead victim does not make it not robbery. With respect to the...
Or not rape.
Rape?
How about rape?
Okay.
Or force?
Your Honor, we have no evidence in this case that this was a gross sexual transmission. We have evidence that it was rape. We have semen deposited in a woman's rectum. We have, though Mr. Uhans did not mention it, bruise marks to her thigh. We have no evidence whatsoever that this was sexual contact, as is required for gross sexual incision, as opposed to sexual conduct, which is required for rape. If perhaps, and I'm citing a hypothetical here, if during his interview, Mr. Carter had made references to touching his grandmother as opposed to having had sexual intercourse with her, we perhaps would have some basis for an instruction on gross sexual imposition. But, Your Honor, we do not have any evidence to that end whatsoever. In the interview Mr. Carter gave to the police, all he said was, or all that he would admit to was, he knew when he left that house that she was not wearing any underwear. That was the end of his confession, as it were, to any type of sexual activity with his grandmother. The evidence came about through forensic evidence, specifically semen in the rectum,
yeah,
and the bruise marks.
So given the sexual issue in this case, it's either rape or nothing.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that to be the case. Because the case law is very clear that you have to have some evidence on that lesser included offense. An instruction on a lesser included offense is not automatic just because it's a lesser included offense. It has to be something presented by one side or the other that would warrant an instruction. And we simply do not have that here with respect to the gross sexual imposition. We have evidence in this case on rape.
What about the conflicting testimony between, who was it, Dr. Cox and who's the other doctor?
Dr. German. Your Honor, conflicting. Both doctors said that there was semen in the rectum. Neither would say that was not true. Dr. German merely posed a hypothetical that, again, was not supported by any evidence in the record. He said, if I can use the term, a sort of splash theory, that perhaps there was an ejaculation and this seeped into her rectum. He was asked by the prosecutor, 500 autopsies that you've done, have you ever seen this happen? And the answer was no. So, I mean, the hypothetical was posed, it was put before the jury. If they found credit to that theory, they very well could have acquitted Mr. Carter on that charge. But they didn't find
it. It seems to me your argument is that the Dr. German never really said, never really contradicted Dr. Cox.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's
okay.
Correct.
Then why did the prosecutor find it necessary to say, given the two doctors, and I'm paraphrasing, I can find it exactly, you probably know what the language is, obviously Dr. Cox, I believe Dr. Cox and not the other doctor. If they weren't conflicting, why did they have to believe one over the other?
I suppose perhaps the fact that the theory was first of all postulated might have something to do with that remark. Perhaps the passion of the closing argument, perhaps his very credentials, if you compare Dr. Cox's credentials to Dr. German's credentials, we're talking several thousand autopsies with Mr. Cox and Dr. Cox, as opposed to 500 autopsies with Mr. German. The educational background, whatever it might have been, if he made that remark, which he did, obviously, it's in the record, that one was better than the other, that obviously, that could have taken in several.
You're saying it wasn't just because of the alleged conflict?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that. Not at all. They did get their lesser included instruction on that, and it paid off. There was an acquittal of the aggravated burglary, and they convicted on the trespass. I would like to, if I could, discuss just a little bit more with respect to the rape issue and the fact that it was not in the indictment. Because that is the first proposition of law that is raised. What I'd like to state on that is what we've already said regarding the fact that, very simply, there was no evidence that this was anything less than a rape. We would also like to point out to the court that, once again, this was never raised by any side that the language was missing. Had it been, the language could have been added according to the criminal rules immediately at that point. Wherever it would have happened in the trial, the indictment could have been amended. That didn't happen.
Do you agree that it is an effective
indictment? I'm sorry,
do you agree that it is an effective indictment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The language is missing, Your Honor.
And it's required to be there under the rules.
Well, he had what we will say is sufficient notice of the charge. And
I understand it's got to be in the negligence.
You're asking me if is it defective. The language wasn't there. Was it such that he couldn't argue his case? Absolutely not. He based his whole theory of his case on the language that wasn't there. So even if, let's turn over to the ineffective.
In terms of actual notice,
he had it in the Bill of Particulars. And I cite the very case out of the 8th District, which I know is not controlling on this court, but if you have it in the Bill of Particulars, you have sufficient notice. And to argue that he didn't have notice simply is his primary.
He argues it's the failure of the critical language his jurisdiction on this charge.
Yes, and I disagree with that.
Can't be waived off.
Well, Your Honor, it was waived off. Because it wasn't objected to, first of all, and because the defense was mounted on that very missing language. If we turn to, for example, the ineffective assistance of counsel argument based on the fact that counsel never said, this is effective, and we want this count dismissed. They based their whole argument on that count, on the fact that this was sexual contact versus sexual conduct. Wasn't anything in the evidence to support that, as far as we're concerned, but that was the basis for their whole defense. So even if they meet the first prong of Strickland that said the counsel was sufficient, they have to go to the next step, was the defendant prejudiced, and clearly it was not, because that was the very crux of the argument that they raised. Furthermore, I point out to the court, as far as the specification on rape, he doesn't have to be charged with rape to also have the jury indict on the specification. And whether or not that language is there for the specification, which is what ultimately gets him the death penalty, not the rape count itself, that was in the indictment and that was proper, so there was no argument there. Finally, on that point, even if this court were to find that that was somehow improper to the point of reversal, you still have the death respect with respect to the aggravated robbery. So while the language is not there, it was an error on somebody's part, I don't know who's, but it, and nobody caught it. We didn't catch it. The defense counsel didn't catch it, nor did the court. It went through, but the defendant was not precious by it.
Ms. Annis, let me ask you this, and if you don't feel qualified in terms of not just being the question to answer, just say so. It seems to me, my perception is that we see increasingly not just death cases, but cases in which the rules are not followed, whether it's a criminal rule or it's a rule regarding which jurors are allowed in the jury room, who's allowed in the jury room, things like that, where the rules are very easy to follow. And we're not talking about gray areas, we're talking about areas of rules and laws that are quite clear in the criminal justice area. And as you know, this court has been fairly, forgiving in saying to lawyers, well, there's no prejudice or it was waived or whatever. I guess my concern is, are we going too far? Are we encouraging judges and lawyers to really not be precise and to not just do it the way the rules and the law say you do it by our accepting the argument as it's made here today? There's an error. The rule was violated. The indictment's a pretty important document. It's a very important document, certainly in the death case. And we say, well, but the defendant really did know how to try the case, and so we let this one go by. So the next one comes, and there's a mistake made, and, well, that's okay. The Supreme Court says as long as the defendant understands what the case is about, we'll let this go. Are we being, maybe I'm probably asking the wrong person, but you seem quite knowledgeable, and I guess I'm curious as to what your thought as a prosecutor is. Again, not cases where there are gray areas, but where the rule has clearly been violated, and we let it go. What's your response?
Well, my response is that the defendant is entitled to a fair trial, not a perfect one. And if amongst the imperfections of this trial is that omitted language, this defendant still received a fair trial. He still received effective assistance of his defense counsel. I know that you use the term that you've been forgiving. This court has been forgiving when there was clearly no prejudice to the defendant, and that is clearly the case here. Just because that language was omitted does not mean this defendant did not receive fair trial.
I guess what bothers me a little is that we say it's not prejudicial to the defendant. That's our judgment. We have to obviously make that judgment to say it. But how do we really know? We don't always really know that a mistake has not been prejudicial to one of the parties. It appears to us that there's no prejudice, and we look at overwhelming evidence of guilt and so forth, and we say, well, no prejudice. But again, I come back to at least my concern. I'm only speaking for myself, certainly. My concern that we're not demanding of counsel and the judges that you just do it right. It's not that difficult to just do it right. I'm not lecturing. I'm just, again, asking you if you want to respond.
Well, again, I think it goes back to the prejudice, Sean. That's why we have the concept of prejudice. That's why we have the concept of harmless error. It's because you have humans out there trying these cases and judging these cases, and the mistakes will happen. You say that the instructions are easy to follow, and they are. Sometimes, yes, sometimes no. But the situation here is when you have somebody clearly, this is not the case to say, from this point on, if there's a word drop from the death penalty indictment, well, we're just going to kick out the whole case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've got others that are closer than this one, I mean, more
yes, you have.
Profound.
Yes, you have. Yeah.
If there had been any number of things could have fixed this mistake, but just how serious was that mistake? In our arguments this morning, in that it was minimal. It did not in any way affect the way the trial counsel handled this particular part of the case. And if the defense attorney could put back, if we were going to hold this as defective and reversible error, the defense attorney could put back and not make an objection and later an appeal raised for the first time.
We expect to see that later. Yes, and in fact, it did happen in post-conviction. So we've been there. And again, they think that it's simply, if they knew it, and just as you're saying, remained silent about it, how did it hurt Sean Carter's case?
And this is just the element of the crime that set forth in Philip in particular.
It was, Your Honor. And jury instructions, when that particular portion was read on the brain, and again, as I stated earlier, that has no effect on the spec, on the specification, just on the count of rape, which in and of itself does not carry a death sentence.
But it seems that we always find that it has no effect on the case. Each time that we, and I join in the Chief Justice's concern, we had one last week or a couple of the cases recently where the alternate juror was permitted to go into the jury room during deliberations. The rule is clear on what it says. And at some point, if we just, there's no question here, the guilt is overwhelming, I think. I mean, it's pretty clear with his confessions what he did and how he did it. But we find that in almost every one of these cases. And I guess if we fall back on it has to be a fair trial, not a perfect trial, then we can always say that. We don't have to fool around with these little rules that we've promulgated to have fair trials. One of the things that concerns me, and I recognize that we can all misspeak, but the court in this case, with regard to the theft, said, well, the court's in agreement with that. I don't believe that there is any possibility that reasonable minds could differ that this was simply a theft offense under the circumstances of this case. Now, reading just that sentence sounds like the court saying this is a theft, not a robbery, to me anyway. Having the murder of Theodore Prince to take place, blood was found in the $20 bill that was circumstantially linked to the defendant from the holding cell in Pennsylvania. There is no doubt in the court's mind that in this particular situation, a lesser included offense of theft is warranted. Therefore, that will be denied. Did he just misstate?
Or? Yeah, I believe so. Or reading it off the record, you're not getting the judge's inflection in his voice. Like
that's why I'm asking you, because
yeah, and I wasn't there in chambers when he said that, but when I hear you read it, I can appreciate that he's saying it in effect in the negative, even though it's read.
I assumed that when I read it as part of the transcript. It seemed to me that in the context of what was going on, he was denying all these motions. But the language is so clear, and I thought, well, at least we're going to get the lesser of theft here, and then, therefore, that will be denied.
And though it should have been read as a negative, and read it as a positive, or you stated it.
I guess I'm just telling you that's the kind of thing, the kinds of things we run into, and then we see the rules violated too, and we think, where, if ever, do we draw the line? And it's hard to draw the line when the evidence is so clear.
Well, and in this case, Your Honor, with respect to that count, all you have to do is look at your own cases as to what the judge must have been thinking when he decided. That, yes.
Well, he was probably thinking about State v. Williams or something like that.
Exactly.
But,
yeah. Which he presided over, incidentally.
Oh, did he?
Yes, he presided over
Andre
Williams. Well, I believe I've stated all that I wish to state for a line of sight.
Before you sit down, I'd like you to address the issue of justice.
It's totally a case of robbery And that's what it is.
No, I'm asking you, if the fact pattern looks like this is a hot blood killing, no, you know, just the conversation deteriorated, boom, he loses his temper and kills grandma. That's not a cure case, is it?
If that's all there was in this case, no,
okay,
it would not have been.
So now, you jump it up to the chair by making the taking of the $20 robbery rather than $150.
That was one, yes.
So how is that bad public policy? You're saying you're giving them a get out of jail free. At that point, if he just leaves, he doesn't go to the chair. And he goes to the chair because he takes $20. Now, isn't that bad public policy?
Well, no. Here's why. We have a situation where the defendant is going to argue the person is dead, therefore there is no force. So do what you want after you've committed the act. We think it's bad public policy to give credence to that particular argument, to suggest that you can commit what I'm arguing to you is the ultimate force, namely a homicide, and walk away from a robbery count just calling it theft because the victim wasn't there to in any way.
So in essence, you think you ought to get the chair inside your murder?
No, I didn't say that. There was clearly a robbery attached to this case, and that is what makes it aggravating. And that's why I feel it is bad public policy to turn around and say, well, the victim is deceased at the murderer's hand, that you somehow then get to take whatever you want from the deceased's body and walk away with it and not...
Without going to the chair.
Without going to the chair, and without suffering all the consequences, yes. But I think that's not a good path for to follow.
I guess what I'm asking philosophically, then aren't we handing out chair cases for what is essentially petty theft?
No. Again, because you're talking about the ultimate force. If she had merely, let's say, been knocked unconscious, then that would still be a robbery case. Mm-hmm. Just because his injuries to her were so severe that she ultimately died from them. That makes it all the more forceful, and that's your element of robbery, and that's why the death specification should remain in this particular case. Well, I believe I've covered about all the ground I wanted to, unless there's anything else that you would like me to address your voice now.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson.
Thank you.
Mr. Uhas, you saved a little over a minute of your time.
In response to Justice Feigner, your last question, I don't see the Williams case or the Byros case as saying that there's no way that it couldn't be. I think what your cases are saying is that this can be robbery. And what we're saying is the crucial factual question is, when does the guy decide to take the money? And you're right. The jury should be left to decide. Does the guy get the chair because he used the force of killing the victim to take the money? Or is the situation as we think the jury should have been able to consider in this case, is does he make a decision to take the money long after the death has occurred? I only see Williams and Byros as saying it can be robbery. Not necessarily that it cannot be theft. And the crucial point, I think, is that should be left to the jury, which goes back to what the Chief Justice and Justice Douglas were saying. I can tell you that these cases are different up here than they are in the trial court. And all I mean by that is, I think it is difficult in your position to say, how can we say the defendant wasn't prejudiced by this? How can we say in this case that the defendant had a fair trial when the jury was denied the opportunity to consider those lesser included offenses of theft and gross sexual imposition? There's certainly medical testimony that I think warrants the instruction of the GSI.
But I think Ms. Anos is stating a different proposition of law than you are. She said the ring off the finger when the defendant is carrying the body outside the house through the fields, I recall, that the timing of the decision isn't critical. It's the fact that this is the person that the defendant murdered, killed, and then takes something of value from the victim. That the timing of the decision, we have said, obviously we said it doesn't, you don't have to form the decision, you don't have to commit the robbery before you murder the person. You're saying, I think you dispute that as a published law, do you not?
Yes, I do, but what I'm saying to you, Chief Justice, is whether I dispute it as a proposition of law or not, even if you say the Williams case was properly decided as good law, I don't think that precludes a jury from being given the option to say, hey, is this a Williams situation, or is it what the defense has done, is that the guy killed his grandmother, panicked, then says, I got to take a car, and oh, I'm going to need some money. Because one of the arguments for the court is that she had like $600, she took $150, so it was only that he made it. And that circumstance is evidence that he only took enough money, thinking afterwards, I'm going to need the money to get bought.
In a murder situation, you have removed the opportunity, you have removed the ability of the victim to exist. There can't possibly be any more support for the victim than there will be dead. So, by accepting your proposition, you are negating by the death itself the very element of robbery that is sure.
With all due respect, I disagree with you because I think, or perhaps you know, I'm not stating clearly what my proposition is.
Do you think
this
grandmother would have willingly let go of her and take the money had she not been dead?
Maybe and maybe not, but I don't see that as a difference between she not home and he comes in. Had she been home, she would have said, no, you can't take the money from my purse now, but if she was home,
and I feel like the witness has created the ability for her to be dead, and created her ability to be dead because she's already dead. And so how, that's, I think, why one of the basis of our decision before was that you can't even have one anymore, because you, by your own actions, created that whole,
I understand that, and all I'm trying to say now is that if there's enough evidence there for an argument, you know, this isn't a situation where the defendant's asking for a charge of disorderly conduct as opposed to murder. Certainly the evidence doesn't warrant that. All I'm saying is that even if Williams used good law, that doesn't preclude the jury from considering the other option that I think Beck versus Alabama requires them to do. Maybe they don't agree with Sean Carter. Maybe they say, we don't think it was that. We think that you killed your grandmother and that was enough force to constitute a robbery.
But the judge makes the initial decision whether to give this lesser included offense based on all the facts. And in this scenario, we had a lot of preceding facts that the judge would take into consideration, which would indicate that she certainly wasn't going to give him this money. There were those facts that the judge would take into consideration.
But I think it is dangerous, and I think your opinions say, the judge shouldn't superimpose his own personal opinion of what the evidence is. He might just...
I'm not saying that. I'm saying there are objective facts in this case that preceded the killing that would indicate that if she was alive, she would not have given him that money. And the judge makes that initial determination in giving a lesser included charge.
Then, if I'm understanding what you're saying, perhaps where we were company is if Mr. Zena takes money out of my briefcase right now, even though I'm present and wouldn't have consented to it, if he doesn't use force to get the money, it's still a theft and not a robbery. And I think that's an issue for the jury to decide. And I'm way out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.